I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Whole Wide World. A rumination in a time of war on the rhyme or reason of global conflict.
The world is being reconfigured along cultural lines.
When resources are at stake, we've always overlooked the civilizational or the identity issues.
I think this could be a war about democracy in the Middle East. I say it could be. I don't know that it is going to be that.
What you're seeing now is a disintegration into a Hobbesian vision. A Hobbesian vision which means a war of all against all.
I think ultimately war is probably best definable as a drug and perhaps the most powerful narcotic invented by humankind.
This hour, we're taking a sort of museum tour of reasons and rationalizations for war. Reasons why the 90s, after the end of the Cold War, were shockingly bloody in the Balkans, in the old Soviet Union, in Africa, and the Middle East. Reasons for a doomsday pall over this new century. In the global era, what is war about? Oil, democracy, terror, freedom, empire, culture, water, diamonds, modernizing Islam, or nation-building in the Middle East? These are all some of the clues we've been offered on the way to the battlefield. In the mix this hour, an anthropologist of Islam, a New York Times war correspondent, an Iraqi Democrat, a Nobel Prize poet, a war economist, and two American scholars whose books foresaw 9/11, almost 2020, from virtually opposite angles. The Whole Wide World is the radio program that kicks the tires of global trends, trends in money and music that travel further, faster than ever, trends in disease and medicines, dreams and panics that can be planetary events overnight as a wired world keeps shrinking. If there's a big idea on the throne of American life in the second Bush era, it's the notion of a clash of cultures or civilizations. With Muslims today, maybe the Chinese tomorrow. The Israeli-Palestinian impasse has been one grim, endless rehearsal of that clash. 9/11 drove it into American hearts and minds, into the nerve center of our greatest city. So it feels now like a much bigger showdown, maybe the West against the rest. The Bush team has taken up the cause with some of Israel's style, willing to go it alone in a hostile world, wary even of old friends, ready to jump into a fight first, according to the Bush doctrine. That's the short form of an oversimplified battle map of us against them in our minds. Question is, what if it's wrong? Samuel Huntington at Harvard anticipated a clash of civilizations, not quite holy war, but a lethal new division of the world along lines of tribe and faith, superseding differences of wealth or market ideology.
Since the end of the Cold War, the alignments are shifting much more along civilizational lines.
The Huntington book was fodder for fights in the faculty club, paper wars among the policy wonks. But then Mohammed Atta and company blew out the World Trade Center, and Huntington's Clash of Civilizations, 5 years old, in paperback, was a sudden bestseller. And his title seemed to be the text of our times. Huntington himself had taken another flight out of Boston to Washington that fateful morning of September 11th.
In a sense, your first thought was this is an Islamic fundamentalist sneak attack of some sort, but was it the clash?
Well, I don't know what you mean by the clash. I mean, obviously, Osama bin Laden has declared a war on the United States, and that's a clash of civilizations. He's against the Western civilization.
But what's the connection with the clash that you made famous in book form?
Well, I was talking there about the extent to which cultural and civilizational identities were coming to the fore among peoples all over the world in the wake of the Cold War. We had a large number of local conflicts going on around the world, largely but not exclusively involving Muslims fighting non-Muslims, and a major danger here was that these small-scale conflicts could escalate into broader conflicts, drawing in countries and groups from each of the two civilizations involved. That's the main theme of my book.
Huntington's alarm bells about the Islamic resurgence sounded exaggerated when I first heard them in the mid-90s. This was our radio conversation in 1996.
They are the people who become militants and at times fanatics and terrorists and migrants.
When his book was new 7 years ago, I asked skeptically if his clash wasn't really a sort of methadone for policy guys who'd got hooked on the Cold War.
There's the underlying problem between the West and Islam. In the Sam Huntington Armageddon nightmare of the 21st century, that population, that resentment, that cultural energy gets allied with China and China's technological and nuclear capacity in a kind of ultimate civilizational showdown with the West. How do we get there? And then what happens?
Well, first of all, Chris, I don't talk about Armageddon or nightmares.
the reader concludes that.
The reader's reading lots of things in, I think.
After 9/11, the clash of civilizations flew out of the bookstores, and we interviewed Huntington anew.
Since the book was published, a number of different things have occurred, not just 9/11, made the arguments that I advanced in the book more relevant. These include, obviously, the Second Intifada, the explosion by both India and Pakistan of nuclear weapons, and the extent to which they were on the brink of war this past year.
Do you claim a certain paternity here or prophecy?
Well, I think what I argued in the book, unfortunately, has acquired a certain validity in terms of what has happened. I regret this unfortunately, as I say, it turned to be to have a fair degree of accuracy.
You're in some strange way bound up with Osama bin Laden's view of the world.
Well, as I said, Osama bin Laden is fighting a war of civilizations against the Western civilization. He makes bones about it.
But are you?
Am I doing what?
Are you fighting a war of civilizations?
I'm not fighting a war against anybody. all I'm saying is this is a phenomenon in the world today, and it's an unfortunate phenomenon, and it can be a major danger.
But the question in my mind would be, is civilization at the core of it? Take the Second Intifada, which you make an instance of the clash of civilizations. It's also a piece of a long history of Palestinian nationalism. It's also part of a very specific real estate fight in Jerusalem and the Middle East. Why do we make it a civilizational matter when it can be defined so many other ways?
Well, it is. It has many dimensions, and including those you've just mentioned. But it also happens that the two peoples involved on either side do come from different civilizations, and this produces a great identification with the Palestinians by other Arabs and other Muslims who are supportive of the Palestinians, and it produces, certainly in the U.S., great support for Israel, which is viewed as sort of an appendage of Western civilization, less so in Europe, obviously. And so it does have this dimension. And the danger, as we saw in the wars in Yugoslavia, is that other parties to what starts as a local conflict can become involved. And in Yugoslavia, you had the Catholic countries in Europe coming to the support of the Slovenes and the Croats. You had the Greece and Russia supporting the Serbs and helping them. And you had Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Iran and Malaysia all providing very substantial support to the Bosnian Muslims, including people coming from those countries to fight in the wars in Yugoslavia. Now, that didn't escalate very far, but that certainly had the makings of a escalation there as people in civilizations rallied to the support of their co-civilizationists who are engaged in fighting.
Religion makes a great rallying cry. Think of Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland. But when it's also a class, colonial, and economic fight, does calling it religious make it so?
Religification of these wars makes it, I think, is significant. It makes it much more difficult to settle. And you have all this religious symbolism, attacks on religious targets, and so wars which may have begun over simple squabbles over pieces of real estate grow beyond that. Now, I'm not saying culture and civilization explain everything going on in the world. That obviously is not the case. But it seems to me it's a good place to start.
There's a great deal of power in the idea of the clash of civilizations. It's not a new idea. It's an old idea in the sense it's been around for 1,000 years. That's why it resonates. That's why it has the power. And after 9/11, it suddenly becomes the idea.
So Huntington's clash, whether you like it or not, is the theory that all the others have to contend with. Akbar Ahmed is the anthropologist at American University, from Pakistan originally, who started hearing the Huntington feedback in the mid-90s from Muslims.
I was on a lecture tour. I went to Morocco, and then I went to the Middle East, and then to Pakistan. And the Huntington clash of theories idea followed me wherever I went, and people were talking about this crazy Harvard professor who's advocating clash. So that is the power of ideas, and that is precisely the power of the idea of a clash. And I believe it's embedded in the history of the West, it's embedded in the psychology of the West, and it's embedded in the culture of the West.
Are you saying that it's really our problem?
Yes, it is your problem, because remember, the clash comes from the West. Don't forget that the Crusades are started by Europe, that for 2 centuries, the Middle East, and that does not mean Muslims, it means Christians and Jews and Muslims living in the Middle East, what is now the Middle East, are subjected to wave upon wave of Crusaders who come there, who loot and burn and destroy synagogues, they destroy churches. And that is the first experience that the world of Islam has with the West. And that, of course, half a millennium later is repeated with the imperialist powers expanding for a century or so, 18, 19 centuries into Africa and Asia, and once again occupying, conquering, plundering, and so on. So the idea of a clash is really rooted in Western civilization.
Akbar Ahmed defines his work as an anthropologist as observing how people in a culture, Islam in this case, see themselves.
What I'm seeing going on is a complete crisis within Islam itself for all kinds of reasons. One of the reasons is the ongoing impact of the West on the Muslim world, which is interference in Muslim politics, support for dictatorships, support for regimes that are friendly with the West and regimes which oppress Muslim peoples. You're seeing the divisions within society between the rich and the poor. You're seeing the literacy rates, which are appalling. You're seeing youth which doesn't have jobs, a youth which is illiterate. You have an explosive situation. So then the definition of Islam becomes the central fact. And here we have this debate around the definition of Islam,
yes,
within Muslim society itself. The Holy Book says no killing, in no matter who and where, no exceptions to the rule. Killing one innocent person is like killing all of humanity. Now, Osama bin Laden would say that's all very well, but we are in the middle of a war situation, and therefore sending in a suicide bomber into a Pizza Hut is also a continuation of the war.
How do you measure the breadth of the support for that idea?
Well, it's interesting, Chris, because I would say 1 year back that this was very much a marginal movement. It was it had a marginal base to it. But I would say 1 year later, it is now moving into the mainstream. Hmm. It has wide support now. I am alarmed. And this, again, I regret to say, I would blame partly, not entirely, on the West and its disastrous misunderstanding of the situation in the Muslim world. That is how a terrorist renegade is suddenly elevated into a pseudo-religious figure. Mm. When you have someone like Osama, who has very shrewdly, very effectively focused on the key issues within Muslim society, he's focused on the Palestinians, he's focused now on the Kashmiris, thus bringing in the South Asia, He's focused on the Chechens, and he's focused on the Iraqi people. He has pushed the right emotional buttons. I would say after the Cold War, the symmetry of conflict, the neat patterns of conflict have completely been scrambled. What you're seeing now is a disintegration into a Hobbesian vision. A Hobbesian vision, which means a war of all against all. And that's why I don't really accept Huntington's theory anymore, because in the 21st century, you're going to be seeing a kind of anarchy, a free-for-all global anarchy. 1 year back, situation different. Today, I would say it's very different and changing and dangerous.
So it's not so much a clash in Akbar Ahmed's diagnosis. It's more nearly an implosion in the Islamic world. Not so fast, says the war economist Michael Clare. The new conflict isn't about anything so grand as civilization, he says. It's a resource war about oil.
You have to go back throughout entire American history to see that when resources are at stake, we've always overlooked the civilizational or the identity issues. You have to think of World War II, when the United States was the leader of the free world, the leader of the democracies, and our adored president, Franklin D. Roosevelt, traveled to the Middle East to meet with King Abdel Aziz ibn Saud, the founder of the Saudi dynasty. When they met, King Saud was accompanied by slaves. This is the president of the United States meeting with the ruler who brings slaves to the meeting. And they formed a pact which said that the U.S. would get Saudi oil in return for a U.S. pledge to protect the Saudi royal family indefinitely. Now, that pact is still in place. It is the basis for 9/11, by the way. And the U.S. continues to overlook issues of identity or civilization in our quest for oil.
Michael Clare is a Cold War scholar who bought into the end-of-history idea after communism. It was a long era of peace that never actually began.
I came to the conclusion that what's going on is an intensified fight over resources. Oil, water, diamonds in some places, timber, fisheries, land. If you look at the wars of the 1990s, you see that almost all of them, not all, but most of them have a resource connection. Religion is a secondary consideration in most cases. Not absent, but a secondary consideration. If you look at the history of warfare in the Middle East or elsewhere, you see that more often than not, it's a war about power and wealth and vital resources. So, for example, the conflicts in Somalia and Sudan, in Angola and Sierra Leone, yes, there are ethnic issues involved in religion, but a lot of the time they're fighting over diamonds. In Angola, what kept that horrible war going was a struggle between the government and UNITA over who would control the diamond mines. In Sudan, it's become a war over oil. The southern Sudanese people want to have autonomy, but that's where the oil is, and so the Sudanese government in the north is using all of its military power to suppress the southern Sudanese so they could control the oil wells in that area. Terrible cost in human life.
So, conflict, going back beyond biblical times, has always been about land and treasure, Michael Clare says. Today is the same and altogether different.
What's new is the type of world we're in today, where the demand for resources is growing at an unsustainable rate and leading, I think, to conflict. And several factors contribute to this new situation. Population growth at unprecedented levels, putting enormous pressure on the carrying capacity of the planet, especially for water and for land. Then you have the growth in consumption, especially through automobiles and other vehicles that consume oil. The world's population is buying cars at an absolutely phenomenal rate. China alone has a potential market for hundreds of millions of new cars. The statistics about what would happen in China are really quite terrifying. Right now, The United States has about 750 cars for every 1,000 people. In China, it's only about 5 cars or 10 cars for every 1,000 people. You see the vast difference. But China's population is 5 times ours. And if they ever approach the same level of car ownership as we do, what the Department of Energy calls the motorization rate, wonderful term, if China ever had as many cars as we do per capita, the amount of oil in the world would disappear in a year.
I think we can recommend that China develop a SUV, a sports utility bicycle.
You combine all of this, and you simply have a unsustainable pressure on the world's resource base. And unless we resolve that somehow, I'm afraid we're going to have more wars over what's left.
Michael Clare is looking ahead to resource wars, a category quite apart from culture clashes or the crisis in Islam. When we come back, the case for a human rights war in Iraq.
This is not a war that is existing in a state of peace. It is a war that will end that war upon the people of Iraq.
We'll hear about Kenan Makiya's democratic struggle and his very nervous alliance with George Bush. This is The Whole Wide World, produced in association with WGBH Radio Boston from PRI, Public Radio International.